Welcome to the Movement Podcast. This show is all about movement. We tackle it from different angles, bring on guests, answer questions, go on a few tangents, and give practical advice, giving you guys a better idea of how you can optimize the human body to be the best it can be. Let's preview what's coming up in this episode. Our guest is Alan Cosgrove. Alan is a world-renowned fat loss expert, author, and business mentor based in LA. In this episode, we dive into topics for young trainers, Alan's background in martial arts, and ideas concerning fat loss and metabolic load. We close with business advice for gym owners during these unprecedented times. We also have a discount code for podcast listeners who want to get certified in the FMS system later in this episode. So let's get going with the Movement Podcast, powered by FMS. On today's episode, we have guest Alan Cosgrove. He's an author. He's the owner of Results Fitness Gym and University, the same name. He's known for being on lots of podcasts, so he's used to this setting, and he's a good friend of the guys. So welcome, Alan Cosgrove, to the Movement Podcast.
Thank you for having me. First of all, I just want to clarify, I know the guys.
Yeah, we've known you for quite a while. I'm really excited to have you on, but friends might be taking a little too far. A real true friend would have our book on the bookshelf and not just promote the fact that you've probably read a lot of books or your newest book.
As you can see behind me, you have my new book out here. But because we're such close friends, I knew exactly what you guys were going to say. Bam.
Hey, there you go.
Predictable, are we?
Yeah.
And also over my other shoulder.
Oh, look at that guy.
And for those of you listening and not seeing this visually, there are books surrounding Alan at the moment. He's in his home library, and there are multiple books that actually Gray has written right behind him.
Notice the Gray Cook, and then with Lee Bird.
The first one, Lee was still getting his driver's permit when I wrote that one. So
it's like the remember the 80s TV shows, and it's like with special guest star.
That's right.
Dude, thank you for coming on this. And in prep, I was reviewing that DVD, that download video project that you and I and Lee did in 2012, and you had a shiny baby face. Now you have this badass fighter, you know, shadowy beard thing going on. But anyway, I wanted to tell you before we get started, because I know you and I are going to do some kidney jabs
here. I thought we already started.
No. Okay. Before we really get started, it was amazing what you did with the group and taking them to a very, very practical place with something that I find most people overcomplicate, and I think you simplified it in an elegant way. So that, I think it's timeless, and many of the things that I think we said and mainly you said in 2012 are as relevant now as ever before, and I think a lot of people hadn't heard it.
Well, I think it's we've talked about this before, that sometimes something that seems like in your bubble, it's common knowledge and everyone knows it. And then you step outside of your bubble and you realize that, you know, it's almost like a secret that no one knows about, right?
Yeah.
And I think if I have any gifts at all, I think it's my ability to take something like that and give it so people can use it, right? And I think what the idea is, and I know I've mentioned this before, is that a young trainer is writing programs and, you know, they're doing a good job, and then they develop, you know, an interest in learning more things, and they learn the screen, and then suddenly they become paralyzed and they're unable to write a training program. They're unable to, you know, put anything together because of their new knowledge. But what I'm trying to get to them is that you were doing good stuff. Use what you've learned to, you know, enhance that. Like, it doesn't replace your old knowledge. It just makes it take you to another level. And that's what we're actually using. I think this is the first time that we talked together about using the functional movement screen to not just screen and write down a score, but to use that to drive your programming for people, right? And not just from a rehabilitative standpoint, from a fat loss or even from a performance standpoint.
Well, one thing that, I mean, Alan, I go back to, you did, if memory serves me correctly, attend our very first FMS seminar on the West Coast back in 2000, I believe. Yeah, and five other people.
Who was it? It was me, Jim Liston, and a couple other people. And it was, who was teaching that?
Keith Fields.
Yeah, it was Keith. And it was when you couldn't buy a functional movement screen kit, you had directions of you need 3 feet of string, a 4 foot dowel rod, and a 2x4, right?
by six.
Yeah. two by six, because that's what we could get the 2x6 vinyl fencing pieces and we'd chop them up.
And it's a 12 pieces of PVC pipe that you could make your own hurdle set from.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And Chris Poirier finally beat us over the head and said, you guys could make money off this thing. Like, really?
Well, we've all, there's been a part of that as someone who's does this for, previously did this for a living before a global pandemic closed gyms. Just luckily, that's why I was so available to do a podcast. At some point when I'm going to charge a premium fee, everything about it has to be premium. And not to this, make fun of it, is it's really, it'd be really hard to do that with a 2x6 and PVC pipe stuffed together, right? So the idea of it being a professional screen, it needed professional equipment. So another point to Chris Poirier.
Right. Well, one thing that, last year, Alan, you did the keynote for Perform Better Summits. I'm pretty sure it was last year. It seems like it's been a while, but it's last year. And you touched on something that I want you to speak in a little bit more, especially for some of these trainers that are listening, is you talked about all the different areas that have influenced you. And you mentioned, the FMS, but you mentioned Westside Barbell, some other organizations out there. I just remember Westside Barbell, but that really struck me how you was able to take all the different influences that you've had along your career and help mold them into creating the gym and your, way of training and philosophy. Give us a little bit more insight on that. Cause I thought that was pretty powerful when you were kind of connecting all those dots.
Well, I think it's really just this, a young trainer search for knowledge, and to find the answer. Right. And everything that I learned, I mean, not everything, some things made no sense, but everything that I learned that I mentioned, it could seem to make sense to me. The analogy I use is it's like the UFC, the Ultimate Fighting Championships. That's an organization, but the sport is called mixed martial arts. And the original intention of the UFC, actually the original intention of the UFC was to create a format where Gracie Jiu-Jitsu would win. It was a commercial vehicle to launch Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But the rule set at the time, there was no martial arts that really knew how to fight off their back, right? In boxing, you would allow in kickboxing, you allow the opponent to get back up. And judo a little bit, wrestling, when your shoulders touched, that was over. So if the fight was allowed to continue, jiu-jitsu had this massive advantage. But the original idea was to decide which was the superior martial art, which was the one martial art that would win. And in the beginning, it was jiu-jitsu. And then it moved when the strikers started to learn takedown defense, it moved to striking. And then the Greco-Roman wrestlers came in. And now when we're looking at, it was 93 that came out. Now, so 27 years later, the answer is none of the above. You need to be well-rounded. And I think training and fitness has to be that. Sometimes the answer is adding weight to the bar. Sometimes the answer is bodybuilding. This kid just needs to get armor on him and get bigger for his sport. Sometimes it's cardio conditioning and sometimes it's a mixture. And that's the part where I think the FMS, it sort of transcended all of that and just goes, let's start with the person and how do they move? And then we'll see which direction they want to move. Do they need to get stronger? So my sort of evolution as a trainer was as I tried to find a training philosophy that resonated with me, what I found was that none of them truly resonated with me because they all made sense. And I guess it became a hybrid model. That the idea of finding the one answer is really a reductionist approach, whereas I tried to have a more synergistic idea. And all these guys that were how can Pilates and the West Side Barbell model exist in the same facility? Well, they can if you understand what you're trying to do, right? Because sometimes the answer is here and sometimes the answer is here. And the answer can't just be add weight to the bar. But sometimes the answer is that. And this is confusing for young trainers, but it's just, this is the evolution of my sort of philosophy, is that everything seemed to work. And it's just, you can take colors and you can just put them all, squeeze all the paint in one big color and mix it all up, and you're going to end up with brown. That's how it ends, right? Or you can create a masterpiece if you know how to add them correctly, right? And that's really what I've tried to do.
Well said. And one of the things that I run into is so many people in a performance model or in personal training have this success model they're shooting for. And FMS is actually a non-failure strategy. Oh, you have no zeros? That's awesome. How many ones do you have? Three. Okay, that's where we start. And what you just said in mixed martial arts is don't have a weakness, right? Before, you said be superlative at one thing, because that's where it started. We already think we know the best fighting style, but the minute your counter, their offensive attack, you go defense, then offense, and put it right back on them. That's sort of that thing that Bruce Lee was trying to touch on. If I walk in with dance steps pre-organized, I'm going to get the crap handed to me. Everybody's got a battle plan till the first, rifle shot, and then things change. So I think that's awesome. And recognizing weak links and removing negatives before you get on with those things that you really want to do, or somebody states a goal and you're like, okay, what are all the cracks that I'd like to make sure are sealed up before we go for that goal, is something that people don't consider until you get wise. Intelligent people go for the success strategy. Wise people basically manage failures on the front end. And I think we've all got handed wisdom the hard way at some point, but that's exactly what I hear you saying. And that's what I've been learning from our model since I started.
And I think it's often the idea of, because you can see what you can add for performance. You can see that quite clearly, right? And that's hard for a young coach to ignore, right? Because I can look at the car and go, wow, we could put in a better engine. We could put in premium gas. We could have it be more responsive. And that's all works until you realize the emergency brake is still on and the front end's completely out of alignment, right? You can release the brakes and open this up with what you've already got, right? There's no, I'm working with a client right now. She's a American Ninja Warrior competitor. And she's about 118 pounds, and she can do sets of three ring pull-ups with 85 pounds. And me as a coach wants to see a 120-pound pull-up just because it would be cool. But she's stronger than her competitors. That pursuing more strength doesn't make her any better, right? Like, this is the trainer out of control. I want to see something cool, but the time taken to pursue that doesn't translate to what she needs to work on, right? Which is perhaps more of a grip, repeated grip endurance type of thing. So it's always easy to see the thing to do more of. It's hard to always see the limitation or the restriction that you can it can eliminate. But once you see that, that's the magic. Like, that's when you look like she calls me a mad scientist or a fitness sorcerer. But I'm just finding the hole. Just finding the weak link and fixing that, and then it allows her to express her strengths. And that's just the same with all your clients, is if you can release the brakes, that you can enhance the performance without having to upgrade the engine, right?
Well, I think that to me is really the fundamental philosophy of what every trainer should strive to do, is find what that weak link is. I think part of the problem, and we're all three of us sitting here are educators, and we've been educators for quite some time, and so we want to get these trainers as educated as possible. And I think now more than ever, there's so much education out there, whether it's on nutrition, whether it's on sleep. There's so much opportunity to become educated, and a lot of these trainers that get educated, they go take a course on nutrition, then all they do for the next 2 months is provide nutrition advice. And knowing how to, kind of what you just described, Al, is don't just mix everything up and then you got brown. You want to get educated, but you can't be so educated that it clouds your judgment and what's important at the right time.
Because that's the part, because the new stuff becomes sexy. And you're like, I've found the answer now, right? And I think that the challenge too is I'm almost 30 now. So I've been doing this not as long as you guys, obviously. But finding information in college and coming up was a hard challenge. Like, I had to go to the library, find the journal, and read to see if the journal article made sense, and then photocopy it, and then
What is that?
I know, right? But now I think a young trainer they need a different skill set, the ability to filter out information. Same as we're talking about with training, is that you have to have a selective ignorance at some level, that you're the immediate, you just type something into Google, right? And without getting controversial, Google returns what it wants to return. It doesn't always return the most accurate thing, right? So whatever you're finding, if you typed in creatine monohydrate, that was my undergrad thesis, was on creatine supplementation. And when you start looking into then, there was maybe 25 articles ever. Now there's probably a million hits of good information at your fingertips. You couldn't read that in the rest of your life. The time you got through 10% of it, 20% has been added. So the skill set for a young trainer now is this ability to filter information, right? And see how things fit together. And I liken program design to like packing for a trip. You don't take everything you own, you just take what you need, right? So if you're going to the beach, it's a different suitcase you'd pack than if you're going skiing, right? So that's the idea, is that what can you learn that can enhance what you're already doing? Because there is a tendency, as Lee touched on, to completely replace what they were doing before with the new thing. Like when they discovered the kettlebell, a whole bunch of trainers forgot dumbbells existed. They just dropped them. They just forgot about it, right? And it's the same with anything. It should have enhanced what you're already doing, not completely replace it.
One of the things I appreciate is you can tell somebody's intelligence more often by their questions than their answers. And I've always appreciated the way that you question. And there was a little Cosgrove sitting right here writing the movement, but knowing, geez, somebody like Alan's going to be reading this probably. And I've seen you go through other people's manuals and actually do the math of what they're suggesting. You're like, it doesn't even add up. Yeah. And so
I think I've become famous for that one time I did that. we all remember it.
Well, I think the spine of that movement book is pretty new. I don't think that movement book's been open much over his left shoulder.
Yeah, I heard it crack when you
opened. I had to buy one, by the way. Thanks for the free one.
Oh man, that didn't happen. Lee was supposed to send that.
Hey, yeah, by the way,
the fighting analogy. You were very eloquent in your UFC discussion. I want everybody here to know how you came to this place and some of the background you have. So I would love for you to elaborate on that, because I think many of your observations are actually from a realistic place, not from reading a book. So give us a pass, man.
So my first I grew up in a kind of rough area in Scotland, where if you went out to play with your soccer ball and didn't know how to fight or run fast, you didn't come home with your soccer ball. Somebody else could go home with them, right? So I wasn't much into running, so I decided I better learn how to hit. So I started taekwondo lessons with a guy who's still one of my mentors today, Derek Campbell, in Scotland, who at the time was a third degree black belt and is now a ninth degree black belt. And I went into competitive martial arts, and I fought different styles and different rule sets, and mainly in the taekwondo world. But at some point, you realize that when two people fight, right, in competition or in any sport, really, it's where two lives intersect and lives go different as a result of what happens in the match, right? So it's one is a winner and moves on to the next round. One is a loser and goes home, and it can have different consequences based on, you know, whether you pursue sport for a career and move to a different level, or if you decide it's not for you. But it always stuck in my head that every match was like my life could be completely different at the end of it. And I don't just mean fighting is like, I think Joe Rogan has said it. It is a chess match with devastating consequences.
Wow. Right.
And that's the idea of what it is. But I started to realize that everybody knew the same techniques. And if we boil it down to something like boxing, right? And amateur boxing, I did some of that. You've really only got four punches, a jab, across, a hook, and an uppercut. Floyd Mayweather executes them at another level because of speed, conditioning, strength, timing, power, and just this understanding of movement and how to move you so that he can hit you and not be hit. I mean, that's the phrase for boxing, is it's the sweet science, the art of hitting and not being hit as a real cruel repayment for you trying to hit me. And that led me down the sports science path to figure out, like, there's a reason. One of the lies in martial arts that you'll hear in jiu-jitsu and judo is you use your opponent's strengths against them, right? So, I mean, the concept sounds good, but then why do we have weight classes? Why does the 15-year-old lightweight girl not have an advantage over the 250-pound male, right? Like, if you can use your opponent's strength against them, then strength would be a weakness. And we wouldn't separate males and females, and we wouldn't separate by weight class. Weight class is just really a raw test for who is the strongest, which is not always true, but as a global idea, a bigger guy is usually stronger than a small guy, right? There are exceptions in the, you know, the weightlifting and powerlifting world. But that always stuck in my head, that all the competitive advantages could be found in improving my own movement and improving my own fitness qualities, use the global term. The technique everybody knew. So it sent me down this path of there has to be a better way. And that's kind of the question that drives me. There's got to be a better way to do this. That's one of my interns a couple of years ago was like, what drives you? I'm like, just why am I so bad at this? That's the one thing that drives me. Why am I so bad at training? Why am I so bad at programming? And he's like, you're not. I'm like, but that's what drives me. And we were watching the ninja girl that I was telling about. They record that ahead of time, but I got to watch her last competition. And one of my coaches said to me, what's going through your mind right now as she's approaching the start line? I'm like, what's going through my mind is, I don't know anything. Like, I'm so bad at this. She's so unprepared, and I'm terrible at this. And that's been really my martial arts path, was this idea that there's something I can do, give me a competitive advantage that's completely legal. If I was as strong as a heavyweight, fought as a middleweight, I can't be stopped, right? And that's just this idea that, and once you figure out this, how to, these difference makers, I just become, you know, obsessed with it, is probably the best way to describe it.
You're in good company, because the fear of failure is what you find when you talk to a Jerry Rice, or if you get an interview that's really pointed to Muhammad Ali or something like that. It's the fear of failure that's driving me. So they set up that obstacle, but it does, because success will be handed to you. But if you get too pulled into that, all of a sudden you're the one telling everybody you're the guru, and that's the day you stop being one, I think.
Well, I think there's also that drive for the fear of failure will drive everyone to a degree, but some people, it becomes so much they never strive, and they're happy to be a big fish in a little pond and not, you know, put themselves out there, that sort of lizard mindset, like you want to just be safe, right? But then there's also this need for achievement, which is why, you know, athletes move up a weight class, which is why they, you know, they try different things, like, you know, it's that their desire to do the next thing drives them more than their fear of failure. Like they don't want to fail, and they want to prepare, but they also don't want to just stay safe either. So I think there's a little combination of the two things. It's like a need for achievement allied with a fear of failure. And then people are driven, like, you can have such a high need for achievement, you become totally reckless, and you have such a fear of failure that you never strive to do anything. And I think some people have such a fear of failure that they try to do the impossible because it has an excuse. Like, I'm going to try to run a marathon with no training, but my built-in excuse is, see, I never even trained. That's why I failed, right? But that's a real fear of failure, is not even trying.
Well, the interesting thing, I'm sitting here listening to you and Gray, and I hear Gray all the time, so I really, really appreciate you coming on, so I don't have to listen to him. But what you guys are getting into, and probably that, you know, people out there listening are just really hearing everything you guys are saying. Hopefully they are, maybe not. Is the psychological aspect that, Alan, sounds like you gravitated to during your martial arts training, is just how much happens in your head and how much you've got to take that to your program design. It's not about sets and reps. That's only going to get you so far. You've got to have that blend and that balance, understanding what's going to motivate someone. And now the sexy word is mindfulness and this and that. But at the end of the day, you've got to create that balance and know, and to be a good trainer and to be able to push yourself, you've got to know what that's going to be. And whether it's a fear of failure or fear of success, whatever it is, you've got to touch on that. That's a huge, important thing that you guys are talking about.
I think it strives from like an intellectual restlessness, right? That there's always a hole in your game, right? That there's something that you can work on. And it's like, I have a sort of personal philosophy that you can complain about something three times, and then that's the universe sending you a sign that you're supposed to fix it, right? Like, it's not, there's no one out there going to give you the answers. You're the only person that seems to notice that there's a problem. And then that's the sort of idea is that you're, and I think that the idea when you're writing a, like, You could win a taekwondo match or an ultimate fighting match with a single kick, right? Or a punch. Which one is correct? Right? There's no, you just have to see the situation. And I think program design is like that, that if you're taking someone on a journey, like a strength program could look a lot like a fat loss program. And a fat loss program could look a lot like a movement program. When you're just figuring out how to solve the problem that's in front of you. And that's, like I said, that Joe Rogan quote, it's a chess match with devastating consequences. And I think programming is a little bit like that. Some people see being a coach as like a job or an obligation. And I've always thought of it as like, you know, like a position of honor, right? Someone put their goals in my hands alongside and said, you know, here's the journey I want to go on. And will you help me get there? And then I just feel like tremendously honored when someone asks me to do that, and they deserve my best. And so I feel that the devastating consequences of letting someone down, that someone, they just want to lose 10 pounds and you can't help them. You let them down. Like, how, I couldn't live with myself not giving my best. And to the point where I'm, you know, up all night figuring out the latest Soviet method to train the toe extensor, you know, just to see if it can give me an advantage, right? So, like, it is, I think that's the lesson I would give to the young coach, is just understand that they can choose anyone to coach them, and they chose you. Don't take that for granted.
Well, it's a great way to cap this. When we were doing that joint venture, you were walking up and down the aisle saying, this person has a fat loss goal, and she's got this many days to do it. You don't hit it, you're fired. I don't care how good her mobility, stability, balance, coordination, yeah, timing. I don't care how good her percent, you know, body fat is or her muscle mass is. She wanted to lose this much weight, and you're fired. You're fired. And you kept saying that and really making them feel that failure. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever been fired. I've probably got some patients that didn't feel success with me, but that is a huge driver. And I think you were really getting under their skin a little bit in a wonderful way as a mentor, saying, if these people fire you, if they don't come back, you failed. Even if you think you were right, you weren't, because you failed to identify and communicate in such a way that caused change.
But with the caveat that this client has hired you and you've taken her money and you've not delivered the goal, but you had the right intent. I don't think anybody in that room was like being unethical and taking money and not being able to do it. But they're like, if you don't get her to her goal, then that was wrong. But I also want to add, if you get her to her goal and her mobility and stability gets worse, I think that's the do no harm rule.
Right.
Right. And this, there's a way to do both. You don't have to choose between the two. You can get someone to, and I would actually suggest that that's the way to get the fat loss to happen, is to get the metabolic machinery working better. Right. So that's the part of the whole concept, is that remember your obligation to the client. If they don't get better, regardless of what you see, you're like, oh, she shouldn't be doing a squat. Cool. She needs to get lean. What are you doing? You got 6 weeks. And then I seen this too with them. There was a move for a while that if you got below below a certain number on the functional movement screen, we wouldn't let you take a class. You had to do one-on-one training or something, because it would be too dangerous for you to move. And I understand that intent, and I understand what they thought they were doing. But that client just goes to another gym that doesn't do a screen and jumps into a class and gets hurt. Why don't they're still better with you, right? That you can do something with them and help them. So that was the idea, is that we take the additional knowledge to enhance what you're doing. And like someone, it's we all grew up in gyms and we're just so comfortable in them. Like, I'm comfortable in like hard, full contact martial arts gyms. But imagine a guy dropping off his daughter there. And you're watching teeth get knocked out and blood on the floor. And this is not where he wants his kid to be. It's intimidating. Right? And we forget that sometimes the gym is completely intimidating for these people. Right. And we're like, man, you move so badly. Get out of here. Can't do anything for you. Like, we have people, when we do a screen, they're like, is that good? I'm like, man, there's no good or bad. It's just exactly what I'm looking for. Like, I'm just right. getting information to design your program. Like, that's the one thing they always ask, is this good? Everybody has this, what's your scorecard? I'm like, it's no good or bad. I'm looking at how you move. Like, this is as much as it's a science, as an art form, right? I'm looking at the quality of movement and I'm helping design a program based on what I see. And what's kind of cool is what I found is that the movement restrictions are usually the jam and the metabolics.
The bottleneck.
Right? That's the jam, right? That's the bottleneck and the metabolic system, right? Like, I've watched guys doing I think we did FMS2 out at the gym, and Brett Jones was the instructor. And I'm watching like a pro mountain biker just destroyed metabolically in a half kneeling isometric hold, right? That guy's not out of shape. He was just in a position where he was being challenged, right? And he was being challenged from a stability point of view, and perhaps there was some mobility restrictions, but he's being challenged there and it expressed itself metabolically. So if you start thinking of that and just take a step backwards, respiration is up, body temperature is up, he's clearly sweating, he's not even moving, right? We don't even have to create movement, right, to create a metabolic load. And I think we lost that with some of these like circuits and AMRAPs and stuff, where as many reps as possible, where we're getting like sloppy movement to try to create metabolic load. We're done correctly, you need zero movement. I can do it isometrically if I put you in a challenging position. And there's something I don't talk about a lot, is that perhaps the sort of cerebral input and the challenge with some of the self-limiting exercises creates a metabolic load that we can't measure. That's why you're exhausted from a cross-country flight where all you did was sit.
Right.
Right? Like, you're exhausted. There's something happened and you're tired from zero movement, right? So I think sometimes and interval training requires a psychological input and to touch what Lee said, more mindfulness than just steady state aerobics. And maybe that contributes to why it works better than steady state aerobics for body comp purposes. And that's why certain other movement exercises and self-limiting things seem to work even better, because of that complete engagement, right? We're not just engaging the muscles, we're engaging the metabolism, we're engaging the brain. And I think there is something there that we've yet to touch upon. So the idea is, like, if I were to give you a math problem during a circuit, would I enhance the metabolic, you know, like, influence? Like, I was looking at Nick Winkleman stuff on external cues, changes things dramatically than internal. So there's something, but we can change things based on how we communicate it. So there's just this whole world that it's, we used to think that we did strength training one day and aerobic training another day, as if there was no connection between the two. And it's, the only reason cardiovascular system kicks in is because the muscular system is asking for oxygen to be pumped there in the form of blood, right? So I looked at one of my athletes a while ago, and they were doing an air assault program on the bike, and they couldn't hit the heart rate prescribed. And they're trying. They're just not able to hit the zone that I had originally prescribed because their legs are exhausted from a previous workout. So you can't take these things and put them in separate boxes. You can't put jiu-jitsu and kickboxing in two separate boxes when you're going to compete in a combined system. And I think that's the idea of when we take it back, it's all movement, right? So it's sometimes we add load, sometimes we reduce load, sometimes we add repetition, sometimes we reduce repetition. But it's this Venn diagram of stuff, right? And my goal is to find which direction I come in from. Simple.
That's beautiful. That's eloquent, man.
FMS is your baseline. The Functional Movement Screen is an objective tool that measures seven fundamental movements that are key to daily life and determines if those movement patterns are optimal, acceptable, or dysfunctional. While the screen is simple and efficient to perform, each test has been strategically selected due to the significant feedback it provides on mobility, stability, and how both work together for larger integrated functional movements. Based on the screen results, FMS professionals can then prioritize exercise and programming to accommodate their clients' needs so they can achieve higher levels of fitness and performance. This highly customized exercise selection protects clients from factors that inhibit progress and produces self-aware clients and athletes who can now reach greater heights in lifelong movement health and vitality. Whether your focus is optimizing training, maximizing client retention, or enhancing communication, the screen helps you get there. It is the foundation for one of our basic beliefs: play to your strengths and work on your weaknesses. Explore our course options and get started today.
Two primary reasons people show up at the gym is to look good and feel good. And most people gravitate and probably show up to your place looking to lose some weight. One thing you're pretty clear on ever since I've been listening to you talk is it's not weight loss. It's really fat loss. And I think you touched on it maybe just a few minutes ago, but kind of give us that different in your world. You're different. How do you explain that to an individual walking in?
So weight loss is just taking up less force on a scale due to gravity, right? Right. I can dehydrate you. I can put you in a sauna for 5 minutes and you'll be lighter. I can give you 3 cups of water and you'll be heavier, but nothing has changed. So it's just this idea that weight is a very crude measure of what you're actually asking for. So fat loss, what weight loss is doing for permanent weight loss or long-term weight loss, we're putting a shortage of fuel into the system and it cannibalizes itself to overcome that shortage. Sounds gross, right? Fat loss is we target the cannibalization, so making sure that the body uses its own fat stores to cover this fuel shortage, right? So it starts with some type of a caloric deficit. And then we do a couple of things to ensure that under these conditions, right, and I'm just going to call it starvation, right? Like we're starving the system at some level so that it has to eat itself to provide the fuel. What we do then is we put in a couple of signals where we tell the body to maintain protein, to maintain the protein, which is the muscle mass, through a higher protein intake, and then we send an anabolic signal to the body to tell it that the muscle is important and we must keep this, and the only thing you can lose is the body fat. So that's a really long way of saying that burning calories alone doesn't get it done. Otherwise, just not eating and doing a lot of walking would be super effective, right? And that just doesn't really work like that. So that's why we create these sort of protocols based around muscular work, not just cardiovascular work.
So tell me behind the scenes. I've got 30 minutes. I can do cardio or I can do a body weight or resistance circuit. And a lot of people, if they're watching their heart rate monitor, could assume that steady state cardio for that amount of time in that package seems like it created more of a caloric debt. But I've heard you say so many times, it didn't change your baseline metabolism. And that's the real thing we're trying to do. And I love your most simple examples, because I've watched a lot of people that have all our credentials and degrees and go, I never looked at it that way. And I'm like, so run with that, man.
I think that when we look at anything through a microscope, we can come to a faulty conclusion, right? So if I was to look at aerobic training through a microscope, I would make the assumption that, man, this burns a lot of calories and it's burning fat at the lower intensities at a higher rate than carbohydrate. And this is definitely the solution to fat loss when I'm looking through this straw at this microscopic level. But if I was to do the same thing with weight training, right, and I was to look at strength training and go, wow, this activity that you're doing is so damaging to muscle tissue that it's destroying muscle tissue, right? And if I look at it close enough, I'm like, you know, if you were to continue this path, as I look through this microscope, this strength training is the worst thing that you can do to your muscle tissue because you're destroying it. And in fact, I could demonstrate that. If you did 30 minutes of strength training and then I tested your one rep max in the deadlift, it would be lower. So I can conclude that strength training will make you weaker and you'll lose muscle. But then I take this global approach, right? And I step back and have a look. And I'm like, training is about a stimulus and a response for an adaptation. That's all. I'm putting a stimulus on the body to create a response that ideally and always creates some type of a long-term adaptation. So if the adaptation is the loss of adipose tissue or losing body fat, then looking at something that the response is to elevate the metabolism and send the signal to lose the fat and keep the muscle, and then I reverse engineer it, I don't come up with steady state aerobics. I come up with a higher intensity strength training program. Now, not perhaps when people hear that, like 3 sets of 10, you know, on machines, that would work better than walking on a treadmill. But there's ways that we can take that strength program and tweak it just to make it a little more metabolically demanding. And I think I've talked this with, you know, Josh Henkin. Whenever he posts like a DVRT sandbag exercise, people are always like, I could do more weight just squatting. I'm like, well, if we take that to its logical conclusion, the answer is always the leg press, because you can use the most weight on that, right?
Right.
But there's some good studies showing that the same weight of dumbbells and a sandbag doing lunges, the sandbag burns about 7% more calories. So there's a movement component to this, right? Where stabilization and this challenging load as it moves creates a more of a metabolic stimulus than just the load. So the answer is not just load, right? But it's if we reverse engineer, what adaptation are we looking for? So therefore, what response are we going to use? And backing it up, what stimulus will I use to create that response? It starts to become really clear that while the answer to a different question could be steady state aerobics, it is not the primary answer for a fat loss question.
I always go at a thing, when you have to control both your postures and your patterns, that's functional. When I let you sit in a chair and push on something, you're not controlling your posture because your static stability is actually mostly done by the chair. So all you worry about is prime mover. And when you're doing something unbelievably light and awkward, that's just posture, but we're not loading a pattern. And when you get an opportunity to make the brain control the posture subconsciously and the pattern purposefully, you're going to expend more calories just because every neuron in the body's lit up doing something. One controlling stability and one organizing force and mobility.
So, Alan, let me ask this question. So, in your example of someone doing a lunge with a dumbbell versus a lunge with a sandbag burns more calories. But even how does doing the movement poorly impact what the person does? So, if they lunge with a poor posture, they lunge with their knee caving in. Yeah. I mean, it's gonna be much better if they're doing it right. Correct?
100%. Yeah. So, there's a place as Gray's talking about there. It's The going super light where you're never overloading the system, right, isn't going to work. And going completely stable where you're only adding load isn't going to work. But we surf this curve, right? Like if you can't move well, adding load just breaks it down, right? It's the example I give is the front end of the car is out of alignment and that left tire is just getting trashed. If we realign it, the performance is better, right? And what we're trying to do, the movement has to be clean. If the movement's not clean, it tells me that if I again take a reverse engineer, these joints are not working optimally. So there's a muscle imbalance around them. And on a real simple level, perhaps one muscle is lengthened and one muscle is shortened so that the joint is compromised, right? But that means the muscles around the joint are not working optimally. And that's the biggest predictor of my metabolism and my metabolic rate. Is it's not just adding more muscle, it's making sure that the muscle itself is working, right? Is it working optimally? Is it being challenged? Is it wrong? So it's, and I'm sure there's a physiologist out there who can take apart my explanation, but could not outperform my results when I train clients, right? But that's the idea, is that the lunge has to be right. The movement has to be correct. You have to be cleared to do a lunge, right? So we take it all the way back. As the answer is lunges. You can't do them. All right, sorry. That's not an answer, right? I've got to develop your ability to do the lunge. But in the cool part is in the process of doing that, the process of putting in corrective exercise, and I hate that phrase, by the way, as opposed to what? Destructive exercise, right? Like, like all exercise should be correct. Like, what's the phrase? All training should be an ACL injury prevention program, right? We shouldn't have an ACL injury promotion program. But if I take that, your inability to do an inline lunge, and I develop that, and I develop that stability, and I develop that pattern, metabolically, we're elevating things. The process of doing it is going to be metabolically challenging, and we're going to burn calories. But the idea of just cleaning up a pattern and thinking that then we'll start training, that's just like, again, we're having these little boxes of this is training now, this is rehab now. There's a place near us that advertises post-rehab training. Isn't that training?
Yeah, like, it is.
It's just the same as training, right?
We just
post-rehab if you're all right.
We just dissected exercise terminology, and way back when there was restorative exercise, pedagogical exercise, which is basically developing a sports skill or some type of skill, and then there's military or something to do with the martial arts. And those were the three pillars of exercise that got us to modern society. And then the word corrective exercise appeared in the fitness community, and the word therapeutic exercise appeared in the rehab community, both using the same tools. But the real question we need to ask is, what are we correcting and what are we doing therapy on? And without a qualitative baseline, as opposed to a quantitative or martial baseline, like winning the fight. So saying you're doing corrective exercise without a qualitative standard and a minimum effective dose is really sort of arguing to do whatever you want to do whenever you want to do it. And so early in my career, I said, there's conditioning and there's correcting. You correct quality and then you condition for quantity and adversity and variability and all those kind of things. But in physical therapy and rehab, we actually said, well, it's therapeutic exercise. That means therapists can only do it. I think basically therapeutic exercise is when we're in the presence of signs and symptoms that are already going to take you out. And corrective exercise is actually a great wellness platform because we're removing risk factors before fitness becomes the agenda. And so, you know, we got to use the terms right, but somebody's like, corrective exercise used to be an excuse for not loading and working out with bands. And I didn't like that at all.
We need these boxes to communicate sometimes. We need these terms so that we're communicating. But where, like, if you see my warm-up has lunge patterns in it and a deep squat pattern in it and reaching. And, like, is that movement or is that strength training if you're not strong, right? And where does core training end and it start being strength training? And if you're elevating heart rate and creating a metabolic response, when does it start being cardio, right? And I think that's the thing when we're looking at where does corrective exercise end? That doesn't make sense, right? Like, it doesn't make sense where it ends, because we're correcting a weakness, right? For a power lifter, corrective exercise could be tricep work for the lockout on the bench press. It's not necessarily injury related, but the concept the other one, what was the other one that was hot for a while? Prehabilitation exercise?
Yes.
Rehab.
Yeah. Exercises to stop you getting injured. That's all my exercises. I want them all to stop you getting injured. But I understand the need to, for communication purposes, that this is we write our exercises. We have a squat pattern and we have before it becomes a split squat or a lunge, we have a staggered stance squat. And they just all blend in my head, but in order to teach it, it makes sense to separate it. So I find the terms frustrating, but I also recognize that the need we have them. But that's the idea, is that if you have a fat loss problem, then the corrective exercise solution could look like a circuit workout, right? But it could look like a isometric weak link challenging idea. Like, if I can clean up movement, I'm cleaning up metabolism. They're linked. They're completely linked. And I can't in my head separate strength. Like, a lunge is a strength exercise if it's heavy, and pushing a sled is lunges for reps, which is less heavy, so it becomes cardio. And then running up a hill is this exact same pattern, and that's pure cardio. I just see the movement. If you didn't see the dumbbells, if you've seen the body, if you've seen the joint angles, then it just looks the same to me if I take everything else out, right?
So when it comes to programming, we were talking about the individual and, you know, taking it apart, you know, what that person needs and where you're going to start from. Do you ever put into play like their hormones and when it comes to an individual and developing their program?
So with, you can see some stuff with without like being unethical with, you know, like younger females, the female cycle can actually be quite conducive to fat loss if you time certain interventions correctly. And I think like Greg Rose and the TPI team have done an excellent job looking at youth development and looking at that stuff with joint laxity and things like that. So again, it's if you look at hormones, and if I just looked at testosterone and this massive web of interconnected hormones, this idea we could just plug one thing in and fix it, right? You start to see the interconnecting effect. We can see that doing heavy training can impact hormones on a level there. Some of the responses we need the adrenaline based hormones to increase during exercise, which will result in more fat loss when we're doing that type of thing. So without blood tests, I don't have all the answers for that, but you'd be naive to not ignore the impact of certain things. When you start looking at like lipolysis itself, or the breakdown of a fat cell, it's insulin can stop it, right? So insulin becomes a storage hormone. So you're aware of the impact on all these things. Yeah. I don't know if a lot of trainers would have access to anything like that in real time, but so you wouldn't actually know. But we can look at things like the response, the hormonal response to strength training, the hormonal response to aerobic training, I can't separate muscle and metabolics. I definitely can't separate hormones and metabolics, right?
We want to take a quick moment to thank you for listening to the Movement Podcast. And to show our appreciation, we'd like to offer you a special promotion. By using the code POD20, you'll receive 20% off our upcoming FMS 1 and 2 virtual course bundle. To be clear, by bundling the FMS 1 and 2 virtual courses, you save $199, but we are giving you an exclusive additional 20% off that total. We're excited about this special event with FMS founder Lee Burton and FMS instructor Eric Degatti on November 6th and 7th. They will be teaching the FMS 1 and 2 live and taking your questions. So to get started on your FMS journey, register at functionalmovement.com/events and use code POD20 to save that extra 20%. So now back to the episode.
I came to visit you one time and I love the way you presented the tour of the gym, Results Fitness, to me, because when I walked through the door, you didn't just show me your new equipment and we didn't just hit the smoothie bar. You actually took me through this serpentine path that every one of your clients almost did automatically, yet they had a coaching moment and it was an individualized systematic approach. And if you could just talk everybody else through what you gave me going through those three different gym environments, but coming out the exit, an entire, I would say, functional and metabolic experience, well played.
So I think that when you start with any business model, and what a lot of people do is they'll start with a business model or a product and move forward from there, right? But I start with the client experience and work backwards. Okay. Right, to create this business model, right? So it starts with the workout itself. How do you design a gym? What equipment do you put in? It starts with your program. It starts with your training philosophy, and it's built around that. So if you can picture walking into our facility, there's a check-in desk where you'll check in, and obviously at the check-in desk, cutting edge move there, I know. And then you move to the left, which we call the ramp portion, the ramp area. Ramp in our world stands for range of motion, activation, and movement prep. I've heard Ian Jeffries, I think, uses a similar term, and his is a raise, activate, mobilize, potentiate. So raise temperature, activate, mobilize, potentiate. Just both, it's funny we both came up with the same acronym describing the same thing, right? But you go to the left. And the reason I use that term is if I said to you, did you warm up? It's 118 degrees in Southern California and you've walked here. Yeah, you're warm, but you're not ready, right? So we start with that range of motion, activation and movement prep. Now, at the end of that, I'm doing some squats and lunges with our clients and maybe some low level elasticity work. I use the term elasticity. Other coaches will use plyometrics, right? So we're starting to move and be a little more dynamic towards the end. So does that look like strength training at some level? Does that look like core training at some level? So it starts to blend, right? And so we move out of that area and we move into our next area, which is our core training. A question I get asked a lot is, why do you train core first in your programs? Well, the answer is you have to train it somewhere, right? Why do you train it last, right? So the reason, there's a lot of evidence on exercise order being an unknown influence in training, right? So if we did the same volume of work, we used to have this idea, if I bench pressed first and then did tricep work later, that the bench press would improve more than the triceps or the specific tricep works because it was done first and we were fresh. However, studies are coming out quite a lot now that's showing when the volume is equated, the exercise that's done first always improves the most. So it's unrelated to being fresh. There's another effect going on. There's some type of neural effect going on there, which I'm not really sure why, and I'm not really sure how it works. I'm aware that it is, though, and I take advantage of it. And I've never had anyone whose core was just too strong. So it makes sense to me to always do it first, right? I've got a couple of athletes, if they failed in a front squat where they fail, just right down. Beautiful. Nothing breaks down. Everybody else has an energy leak where something collapses and it's usually the core. So our next movement is core. And so I've now had you do a lot of movement and we've done our core development work. And then we move into power, which is just there has to be a high speed component at some point to everyone's training program. We used to think people who aged, our issue was a cardiovascular issue. And then probably in the mid to late 80s, early 90s, we started realizing the importance of strength training for the senior population. And I think that I can take it a step further, is that the ability to produce power and move quickly is above that. So we train power at that point. If you ever see an old person fall, it's horrific. They move slower than younger people, but they fall at exactly the same speed, right? That's the part that I have to prepare people for, right? For making a step to decelerate. I watched a client, he's probably in his 80s with us. I watched him, I've seen him age with us, and I watched him once stumble in a race because he couldn't get his foot out in front of him to decelerate. If I'm training that guy and I'm not doing some type of component with speed, I'm doing him a disservice. So power comes next. But that starts to look a lot like strength training, which is my next part. And as I'm doing this, if you can picture, I'm moving to different zones in the gym. So there's a group following you so I can maximize my space. I can have a lot of people in the gym at once, but there's a few people in each area. And then we finish with metabolic work, which starts to look like kettlebell swings, battle ropes, sled pushing, and we can do some air assaults. And as you finish there, you've come in a full circle to the gym, and you're back in at the check-in area, which is also where we have protein shakes and fruit. So we can put in the first good meal post-workout. I can hand it to you right there. So the whole thing is, I have different zones for each thing, but it's seamlessly integrated from check-in to leaving with your post-workout nutrition as one seamless experience. And yeah, you may spend a little more time in certain areas, and your strength training may look like power training, and your power training may look like core, and your core at low level may look like our warm-up, right? So it does start to blend, but it's I move you through the gym in that experience, right? I move you through how to you know where you are in your workout based on where you're standing in the gym most of the time, right? We move you out.
The thing I loved about it is your traffic flow and your philosophy line up perfectly. And it was refreshing to see that you thought through your philosophy, but wanted a living, breathing example of that. And you never had to tell me your philosophy, but then you showed me that traffic flow And I'm like, yeah, everything had a reason and everything set up the next thing. So anyway, now bring that to our business model. How do you teach other people to do that? Because they may not have the same situation, but that philosophy is still there, right?
Yeah, well, if you think it, start with your own philosophy. I think a lot of people look to adopt someone else's instead of develop their own. And I can't fault that because it does fast track you. Like if my young coaches with me, if they should be starting with my philosophy and going further. Like you don't have to go back and study what I was studying 20 years ago. And because you're smart, you're going to come to the same conclusion as me. You got to start here and move forward. But we'll start with your own training philosophy. If you believe that the first thing you should do is static stretch or foam roll in your facility just for the purposes of traffic flow. When someone comes in, if the first thing they're going to do is foam rolling, where are the foam rollers? They're at the back of the gym. Why? Why don't you put them right there at the front of the gym? And the next section is, the next thing we do is our heavy barbell lifts. Where's the squat racks? Where's the benches? It better be right next to the foam roller. Right. Otherwise, we're just creating this cross pattern where it just you lose the valuable real estate in a gym. Every square, like one of the reasons I hate machines is not because I hate machines. It's that they take up a massive footprint that can only be used for one thing. I can isolate the quads with space. I don't need a leg extension machine that takes up, you know, 6 by 6 square feet or something like that. Right. So the training philosophy has to reflect your layout and how you deliver it, right? So it's really about, can we maximize our floor space? Can we maximize flow, right? So it's you know, when they board the plane by zones and then they don't, the zone one is the front. That doesn't make any sense. But load it from the back.
Zone one should be the window seat.
You can load the next group and the next group and the next group, and it will flow better than loading the first. And like it makes no sense to me that first class gets on board first. I don't want to, if I'm flying first class, that's cool. I hate flying. I want to be on the plane the least amount of time. So bring me on at the last second, right? Like the least amount of time I need to spend is like everything's backwards, and I can't help but see it sometimes.
Well, based off your background, Alan, you certainly didn't have a business background, much like Gray or I. We run a business now because we, you know, kind of forced into it, and that's what happens with most trainers. So, what are the things you had to run into early on running a business that you just had to figure out on your own that now you can, you know, pass on to some of these younger trainers?
I think everything was a solution to a problem. Like most everything that's, I don't want to say a breakthrough, but most everything is a solution to a problem. We moved from the one-on-one model to a small group model because we'd maxed out space and like I couldn't fit anybody else in the training session. And I have this joke is, where did one-on-one training come from? Because you don't do it a lot in physical therapy. You don't do it in strength coaching. They only came in fitness. And my only answer is the very first guy who got asked to train someone only had one client. So it was one-on-one. And then that second client arrived. And if he just said, come at the same time, the industry would never have existed. He put him in another appointment. Like, and that's where the whole industry came from. So there was no science behind it, first of all. So that was the first part as a solution to a problem. And then it was like, how do I write a program from scratch every time? Don't people fall into these buckets where I'm like, this is kind of the same? So then I started to develop a template for programming that, because my thought process was always the same and the answers were most of the time going to be similar. And then how do I schedule these people? And then how can I fit more people in? Well, let's make sure all the warm-up is done here and then we can move this so I can fit people in and we move. And it just kind of became the solution to all the problems. And then I was teaching programming and fat loss for Perform Better. And then I mentioned something about small group training once and all the questions that people were asking me were about that. So the next year I talked about that. And then at the end of that, I mentioned people were asking me questions like, how do you even explain that? How do you bill them? And suddenly you're answering business questions and you're doing business talks all the time, right? So it's just that idea is that as a coach who's trying to find solutions to people's problems, the attendees that perform better started asking me business questions. So I was like, well, here's what I do. Here's what I did. And feel free to, you know, swipe and deploy. And just, you know, no need to reinvent the wheel. You can start here and make it better from here. But that's the basic idea. Again, it just keeps coming back to every single thing I've done was a result of me messing something up prior to that. Right? And that's the...
Oh, yeah.
Like it was my... I think I stumbled upon you guys because of that. My idea to what do I start with? Like all the fitness testing I'd ever seen were on fit people standing broad jumps and vertical jumps and VO2 max tests. And I'm looking at these people, they shouldn't be doing that. Right. The old model, I talked about this on a seminar once, is that we used to warm people up. The idea was we'll get physiologically warm, we'll increase the body temperature, and then we'll stretch because your body's warm. Now I've got people walking in who should not be doing anything until we kind of realign them. They've been sitting all day. The first thing we do is static stretching, which completely breaks the old rules. And I'm okay with breaking the old rules. As long as you knew the rules, right, you can break them. But that became a solution to a problem, is that warming people up who were all thoracically hunched over with short hip flexors from sitting on a computer all day didn't make sense. I had to sort of unroll them, and then I would get them to warm up. So again, it's just what's the problem you're having and what could be the possible solution to it? And then it expresses itself in a form of a business model that is completely bulletproof to everything but COVID-19.
What you said and what lined us up in the very beginning, and Lee says it a lot too, is if you put the people in buckets, you will find that you don't have 100 individuals. You have 3, 4, maybe 5 buckets, depending on your population. And those people can actually be put into small groups and have a group energy. And one of the things you said when you were first talking about these small groups is a lot of personal trainers that had a one-to-one business model didn't realize the financial potential of taking a bucket of people with similar problems and letting group energy be the other coach in the room. Yeah. And so when people gave you a little bit of pushback, you're like, okay, we teach you to shoot firearms and drive cars in small groups. We can't teach you to exercise. But that countermeasure was great. But you showed people there's a much better business opportunity here. There are going to be one-on-one situations with clients, especially during assessment and things like that. Outside of that, tap into that group energy. It's the other coach in the room that you fail to recognize. So.
The argument against it just collapses. Like it just collapses. I've got a slide somewhere, and it's like 3 or 4 people in a physical therapy setting hooked up to a stim machine while their feet are in an ice bucket of water plugged into the electric socket on the wall. Now, explain to me why that's completely okay, but someone should not do a bicep curl unsupervised, right? And, just the model starts to collapse. And the other part is that most people going to the gym don't have any coaching. So if the model was correct, that small group was perhaps less effective than one-on-one, and I reiterate, I disagree that that's the case, but if it were, most people exercising and going to the gym or working out at home have no instruction. So anything I can do to have me help more people will help more people. And I think the group dynamic is the key. Right now we're using an app with videos of the exercises on it that all our members were getting. So now I have the group dynamic and I have an assistant coach on video. That elevates the results so much because I think there's a tendency, Frank Nash has talked about it, for a coach in certain gyms to become like an exercise kiosk or a workout facilitator where they're just, hey, what is this exercise? And you explain it and the client goes away and does it on their own. And that's not coaching, right? And that's not what I'm about. So anything I can do to enhance the energy, right? That if you were training for like the ultimate fighting championships, right? That's a very extreme one-on-one sport and there's 3 guys in your corner all the time. That's the power of the group. Right. And you wouldn't train on your own to do it. You would train with a group. So let's just tap into that and make that part of your business model to enhance your product, which is the results your clients are getting.
And what would I think you're speaking strength coach to personal trainers, yet you're working with a majority of non-athletes at the same time. Yeah. So there's something about a good, efficient, results-oriented strength coach mentality that actually unburdens many of the rules in personal training that we never asked for anyway. They just, I see some personal trainers and they run around like waiters, not like coaches. And I'm like, you're a coach, man. Step up, you know?
Yeah, you've got to, I mean, you're still working with people, right?
Right.
And it's the Bill Bowerman line from Nike is if you have a body, you're an athlete. And that's the sport of being a mom is extreme, high level and super demanding, right? So we start looking at everybody as athletes. And I think you have to empower people. You should be looking at your clients. I want to be the last gym our members ever join. But with that said, I want to develop some autonomy. I want to coach them and I want to educate them to make myself something that's just they check in with, right? They don't need me to supervise every single rep, every single set. You got to empower them, right? Like they've got to go on and do their thing. And you see some of the like the asymmetrical loading and things that we do, and people are like, wow, that's totally dangerous. You're rotating. I've got a video of my sister-in-law getting out of my truck, carrying my niece with one arm and shopping bag with the other hand and walking with this asymmetrical load to my front door where she drops the keys, does a curtsy lunge, puts the bag down, curtsy lunge to pick up the keys, puts them in her mouth, picks the bag back up, takes it out, opens the door, and I got a video of her changing sides to put the bag down and climbing stairs. There's not an exercise on any machine on the planet that replicates that. So if I'm teaching her a circuit of machines, I don't even prepare her for taking her daughter out of the car, right? I've got to start looking at movement, and I've got to teach them, and I've got to coach that. I can't just put that and say, do curtsy lunge with rotation reach on one leg with an offset load. Like I've got to develop it. I've got to improve it, but I've got to empower her for real life. And a good coach should be becoming increasingly redundant, right? Which is the key thing is if you've really empowered your people. But if you build a business model upon people should be graduating from you, I don't think you'll ever go broke. I think that when you create a business model that people are going to be entirely dependent on you, you have a scalability issue, and then eventually you're going to go under because people won't be dependent on you.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because the responsibility of education is something that the coach should also say, should also have. And a lot of people create, in both rehab and fitness, create unnecessary dependence. And the goal is at any given time, either independence or performance. If you need more performance, you're going to need help. And if you want independence, then I'm going to need you to take ownership. And we're going to one of those two places. And secondly, even with the funny accent, you are one of the best guys I've ever heard at painting a word picture.
I don't have an accent. You have an accent.
Lee's got an accent.
I think, you could see it like with outside of insurance stuff, right? If you're going to see a physical therapist, you better get discharged at some point. Otherwise, that guy sucks, right? Like, never got better. Like, you've been going to see a physical therapist 3 times a week for 4 years and your knee still hurts. Yeah, there's your sign, right?
It was a chiropractor one time. I think he gave away a free mug for, 100 visits. And I'm like, ooh. the guy was happy. He had the mug, and the guy was happy to give him the mug. And I'm like, this is a lot of dysfunction here.
That mug cost $5,000 and copays. I think that's a idea is that I've done some business consulting with people, and I'm like, hey, look, I think you're good right now. I don't think you need to check in as much as you used to. And I think you can be at a different package or something like that. And I think if you're not, it's easy to try to keep people to try to keep a client by not empowering them, right? But it's even more powerful to empower them and educate them, and they can leave should they want to, and they'll always be moving well because of you, right? And that's the kind of cool part of if you have it all ties back into that business model, right? And the solution to a problem is, if this client never improves under my watch, I really don't think I'm a good coach, right? They have to be better and be able to do stuff without me. It's some At some point, you graduate from swimming lessons, and if you want to continue swimming, you get a swimming coach, right? But the level of coach changes, and I think it's the same in fitness, is there's at certain levels, and I think perhaps the future of the industry is more of a consultancy role, where you come and see me for certain activities that we work together for a short period of time, and I'll supervise some of the sessions, and then I think remote, there's a move right now with online coaching, and I prefer the term remote coaching, because I've always given like my obstacle course racing athletes the running programs to do on their own. I don't stand at the side of the track, you know, timing them. They just report in. So I think that's the future, is this maybe a consultancy model where I see you occasionally, but I have a big network of clients that will check in not as often, and it'll be, you know, just change the way fitness is done has always been our motto.
I look forward to you guys showing us how to do that, because I think that is an opportunity, and I think that extra chapter on your university, I think you can lead the way, because you've already got that trajectory. It's not, it's independence, but there's a lot of work to do to get there, and that's fine.
Yeah, I think, well, it's the, do you, if you lose the client, like that's the phrase, I don't want to lose clients. I'm like, I think you can get more clients, you see them less often, and they become independent, but because you're the person who set them on that independence, they become interdependent, and they keep in touch. Like, I still talk to my taekwondo instructor, right? I'm obviously not in class in Scotland this evening, so it's but you know, someone who takes you on a journey, you don't forget about them.
The best universities got really enthusiastic alumni, but they're not doing the class anymore.
Yeah, right. Like, that's the, it's, I've seen one, and it was a martial arts school, and it's like, you know, less than 1 in 3,000 people here get their black belt. Our program is so arduous. I'm like, imagine Harvard using that sort of like sales pitch. Like, we're so bad at teaching, no one passes. But it sounds like, right? Like I've never lost a client. Like, really? That also sounds like no one ever graduated your program and can move without you. Like, what a terrible instructor you must be.
You're a wise guy both ways.
So, Alan, you've had some excellent advice for the gym business owner. I really love the idea of maximizing your space, especially now. You know, lots of gym owners are potentially going out of business or losing their rental property because they can't necessarily afford it. And so they're thinking they need 5,000 square feet or 10,000 square feet. That's what they're used to training in. And so now maybe they can go to a smaller space, be more efficient with it, try this newer model, and be more successful and be a better trainer for their coaches. So I thought that point was excellent. As a previous gym owner myself, I definitely had the experience of losing a client because she felt more independent, and timing, it just didn't work anymore for her to come and visit me as often as she was. So she went to Rogue Fitness and purchased her own equipment and was just kind of checking in. She'd come in on Saturdays and then maybe another time a week. And so I definitely felt like that was a strong point in giving her the love for excelling her fitness and working with the barbell and dumbbells, and then giving her the independence and the knowledge behind it. So I think that was a great point that you made, that a lot of trainers don't see, is that you want them to graduate and to be appreciative of the knowledge that you gave them. So that was an excellent point. Speaking to those trainers and coaches and gym owners specifically, do you have any like inspiration if they're going through maybe a hard time right now? You've obviously been doing this for a very long time. And so is there potentially an example of coming out of something or some inspiration you can give to them to kind of see them through this time?
Nah.
I told you.
It all sucks.
It all sucks. Come on, guys. I mean, this too shall pass, right? There's been challenges. I've had personal health challenges in the past, and all I can say is that I think it's just from Jim Rohn, is no matter how dark the winter is, there's never in the history of ever been a double winter, right? Springtime will come, and I can assure you is, if all the coaches and trainers listen to this, if you think of the average trainer and how bad they are, remember 50%, because of the word average, 50% are worse than that, right? So the fact that you're listening to this podcast and in choosing to sort of invest in your own education means you're at the very top end and you'll be okay. you'll be okay. It's there's one guys not listening to this podcast and not studying business and not investing in themselves, and they're the ones to go, and you'll be okay, with the caveat that all the bad ones are going to go away and competition's going to get bigger because the best ones are going to be around. And so step your game up.
Tell me about the new book real quick.
The new book is actually our first book we've ever written for the fitness trainer. This is the professional. It's called The Secrets of Successful Program Design. Give you a little look at it from Human Kinetics. And it was really just how it's my recipe book, right? Like that's me and Craig Rasmussen, who's my head guy. It's like, this is our recipe book. This is our book of our Gordon Ramsay book of our favorite recipes and how we come up with them and how we sprinkle in the seasoning and what we do. So that all the books I've written up to now were just like aimed at the end user. So they got the actual, just the workouts, but this is a sort of the method behind the madness and the madness behind the method too, right? Okay. So that's the idea, is just like, here's my recipe book of how I do things, with the disclaimer that I reserve the right to continue to learn, and I expect at some point this will be completely outdated and no longer what I do.
Like your buddy Mike Boyle, who says, don't buy the book I wrote last year, buy the one I'm writing this year. So, yeah. Yep.
I love the business model too. Mike's on Functional Strength Coach 27. Right? Because it just... you have to buy the new one, but also to get a complete understanding, all other volumes as well.
Fast and Furious, man. It's a great franchise.
Alan, thanks so much for being on today. I was excited knowing you were coming on because you always bring it. You have so much knowledge and wisdom. We've known each other for going on 20 years now, and I learned so much. So definitely appreciate it.
Hey, brother, all I can say is it's good to see your face, and it's good to hear your words. And as always, very wise. Thank you, man.
Thanks for having me on, man. We've been on, I was just thinking the other day that I'll have to insult you before we come off of this, but you guys and some of the Perform Better crew, they're not just, other than my friends and family back home and my wife, this is some of the longest relationships I've ever had in my life. And I appreciate it very deeply.
No, man, we can go.
And you suck as well. You suck.
I was just like, come on. Now that, now don't end on that.
Now I feel you, brother.
That'll do it for this episode of the Movement Podcast. Thanks for listening. And if you liked what you heard, please take a minute to subscribe, share, and review. If you want to learn more about our system and take the next step in your movement journey, visit us at movementpod.com. Until next time, remember to first move well, then move often.